When Dee Dee Rosenthal fails to show up for work, her coworkers are immediately alarmed. Known for her professionalism and dedication to her job working with autistic clients at the Elwin Institute, this was out of character for the 32-year-old woman. When coworkers went to her apartment, they found the door unlocked and newspapers building up outside. But inside, everything looked completely normal, except for the fact that Dee Dee was nowhere to be found. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Laura Ault.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, did I let you know that I'm finally applying for my Canadian citizenship?
So I didn't know that you were applying, but it's not surprising because you've been trying to look for ways to flee the country for a few weeks now.
Right.
I mean, what were you talking about last week? Was it like Ireland or Scotland or something?
I was trying to figure out how to move to Scotland. I've been trying to figure out how to move to Italy. But no, my family is Canadian.
I know that, yeah.
And you are Canadian.
I am Canadian.
Yes. And so, yes. You know, my husband was like, you qualify for Canadian citizenship, but did you just fill out the paperwork? And I was like, sure. I mean, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, because you're a first generation American.
Yes.
Yes. Your mom is like,
yeah,
as Canadian as I am.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm first generation American on my mom's side, but like also like seventh generation on
your
dad's side.
So it goes like way hilarious. Back on your dad's. Yeah. So yeah, you have like a very unequal
presence in the United States. But anyway, so I was thinking about having to get my paperwork because like there's all these like processes you have to go through. And like during that, I started thinking about like in general, like Canada and, you know, we've had conversations before. And I don't know if maybe our listeners want to chime in, like, should we also expand into covering Canadian missing women? Because
well, I would like to. Because I, like, there's a few stories that I would have liked to talk about from there. But I know that we were keeping it mostly American. But, I mean, with both of us being Canadian.
I will officially be Canadian soon.
You will officially. I mean, but I mean, your mom is definitely.
Yes.
You are definitely. You will officially be. I am.
I will officially be, yes.
And there are a few stories that are not only Canadian, but they're also like very, very close to where I lived and some involve people I knew.
Right.
So it would have been nice to cover some of those things. But yeah, we've always tried to stick to like
The American
stuff. So yeah. I don't know. We'll have to see like how many Canadian listeners we actually have.
Right. Right now, I know my cousins listen.
Yes. And I know one of my high school best friends listens. Hi, Kelly.
but this line of inquiry, so I'm like thinking about like doing my paperwork, right? Mm-hmm. And then I was like thinking about like, oh, okay, well, we kind of focus on like being missing in America. So despite America and Canada being side by side and sharing this border, like culturally, there's some differences. Politically, there's some differences. Mm-hmm. Like there's just some differences.
There's some differences.
And so then I was like, oh, you know, like, and because I grew up in America, I'm much more familiar with, like, American procedures for things and that kind of stuff. But I started to think, like, oh, are there any Canadian women who are missing from America?
Okay, so a Canadian that moved here and then went missing?
Yes. And so that kind of sent me on this line of inquiry, and it brought me to this story that I had not heard before. And so all these components are just kind of coming into play. So I hadn't heard her story before. And so I'm glad this kind of line of thought brought me to this destination, is what I'm saying.
It's like the most roundabout way to get to a story.
I'm sorry. That did take up a lot of time, but
no, that's okay. No, but just like even your process, yes. All of it.
All of it. My All process it. For everything takes a while, right?
Yeah.
So this was the thought process, and that's why we are covering today a Canadian woman who went missing in the United States. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Though our missing woman was named Yetta Sharon Rosenthal at birth, she would simply be aghast if she knew everyone was using that name publicly.
What part of the name? The whole name? Or the Yetta.
The part. Yetta. So, like, aww. After all, as a child, she literally made a friend go into a different room because she was worried her friend would overhear someone calling her Yetta. She despised her name, and she changed it to Dee Dee as soon as she could. So while we're using both names in our episode description and title so people looking for her story can find her no matter what they search for the rest of the episode, out of respect for her preference, we're going to refer to her as Dee Dee.
I think that's best.
So Dee Dee was born in 1958 in Montreal, which is not far from us.
That's where I was born.
Yep. To Dorothy and Victor. And the family stayed in Montreal until Dee Dee's parents divorced when she was four. She seemed to primarily live with her mother in Hamilton, which is in Ontario, and today kind of considered one of the outer reaches of the Toronto metro area. At some point, her mom remarried and she was joined by a stepbrother named Blaine. Blaine is going to come in quite frequently in this story. He's older than Dee Dee and he kind of sees himself as like a father figure to her. It's important to note that Dee Dee is incredibly driven. She graduated from Humber College in 1980 in a counseling program. Now, the language used to describe her work and her degrees is not the language we would use today, but essentially she's trained in working with both neurodivergent clients, particularly those who are autistic, and in helping those with mental illnesses, particularly when those symptoms manifest in violence. And so also the intersection of those populations when applicable. It's with this work that she moved to Red Deer, Alberta to work at the Michener Center. Now, for our Canadian listeners, this name might be familiar because the Michener Center was a controversial residential facility that primarily housed and treated, and I'm using big air quotes around that, those with mental illness and neurodivergence. Much of the controversy about their programming they had because their programming included forced sterilization. So put simply, eugenics, right? Mm-hmm. So when Dee Dee was there, this didn't seem to be part of their protocol, but it's important to note that the Michener Center no longer exists. It was closed and the buildings destroyed. But while she was there, that's kind of in line with the work she was doing, not the sterilization, right? But the treatment at Michener. Anyway, back to Dee Dee. While in Red Deer, she was roommates and friends with a woman named Donna. And Donna would later make clear that living with and being friends with Dee Dee wasn't always the easiest thing. Donna says that despite having a professional job, Dee Dee was known around town for bouncing checks, meaning she would write checks for more money than was in her checking account. And then when businesses went to cash those checks, they wouldn't be able to get what they were owed. Now, for our younger listeners, that means also back in the day, some businesses would publicly display those bounced checks. And this is what happened to Dee Dee at the Parkland Mall and the Lucky Strike variety stores around town. They're displaying her bounced checks on their windows.
It's kind of a weird practice, right? Thinking about it, but it was a thing.
It was, yeah. Or they would have them on display like at the checkout.
Yeah.
Right? It was like a shaming, public shaming.
Public shaming. Just stick her out there in a sandwich board saying, I bounce checks.
Right. Yeah. Basically, yeah. Okay. But these businesses aren't the only ones who were dealing with Dee Dee's questionable financial behaviors. Donna says this. She got stuck with Dee Dee's $1,200 phone bill, and this was enough to kind of end their time together as roommates as well as their friendship.
That's a big phone bill.
It really is.
It really, I mean, that was in the 80s?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. Yeah. She definitely had friends. So she's calling, long distance, I'm guessing. Because long distance phone bills were just astronomical.
They were.
If you were calling from Alberta to Ontario,
yeah.
But also she had friends internationally, so.
Hmm.
Yeah, she's racking up some bills. I mean, Donna and her later become friends again, but this would put a big pause on their friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Donna says after they parted ways, Dee Dee went to go live with two men and they had financial issues with her as well. At one point, they locked her out for not paying her bills. And during another incident, they had her car towed. In Donna's opinion, Dee Dee's problem was that she always wanted to come across as rich and that she would have been better off without just all this pretense. After 6 years in Red Deer, Dee Dee returned to Hamilton, where she worked at the Oaklands Regional Center starting in 1988. While there, she lived in a pricey area and was constantly throwing catered parties. But in 1989, her work life changed. First, she attended a conference in Pennsylvania on the topic of autism and listened to a presentation by Dr. Ed Hartman of the Elwin Institute. Founded in 1852, Elwin is recognized as the oldest educational facility for those with intellectual disabilities. Unlike the Michener Center, it still exists today. But in 1989, at this particular conference, Dr. Hartman handed out note cards and asked attendees to write their questions on them. And Dee Dee did. Her question was, "Can you give me a job?"
It's very direct.
She is, right? Like, yeah. That's like bold, and it's kind of like the thing that you're like, oh, like I wish I was that person, right? Like, yeah. That, like, put yourself out there kind of person, not the run up the $1,200 phone bill situation.
I'm having a feeling that Dee Dee kind of fits into that category of women who don't sparkle. We have this conversation a lot.
Right, because there's that meme that says, essentially, like, I don't want to light up a room, like, those women go missing, right?
Yeah.
Or are murdered, right? Like, I think Dee Dee's, like, a complicated person.
She's not lighting up rooms, but she did go missing, and she still deserves to have her story told.
Right.
So, well, it's, like, a very complex place, right? Like, we've covered a few women like this. I feel like we could, like, almost have, like a whole, like, series of just...
Complicated
women, right, who go missing. We still have to have compassion for these women.
Yeah.
But... it seems like our culture is usually, like, very geared towards, like, the sweetest and the sparkliest.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, like, in some ways, our level of care, we demand, like, perfection of people before we're ready to sort of have empathy or care for them, right? And I think that really diminishes us. It diminishes the complexity of people, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, like... you know, for some people, like, Dee Dee was complicated and, like, you know, their relationships with her were complicated. But for other people, like, she was the person who lit up their rooms.
Right. Like, and every spicy person lights up somebody's room, too, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So she writes this note to this doctor and asks him, "Can you give me a job?" And he did. But it would take 8 months of work with the U.S. Immigration to prove that Dee Dee's skills were not replicable by applicants in the United States. So while she was waiting for this to happen, though, she was attacked by a client at the facility she was working for in Canada.
Like a physical attack?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So this attack actually led to an injury that necessitated giving, like, Novocaine shots in her shoulder. So it's pretty rough. Her job, and that's the other thing, like, the job that she did is so necessary and needed, but also was, like, had to be, like, really hard to do, right?
You have to be mentally strong to do that job, yeah.
But all that did not stop her from moving forward with her decision to head to the United States to work with Elwin. This move, though, was not fully supported by everyone. First, her stepbrother, Blaine, the love he has for her is enormous, right? He begs for her not to go. He felt like the United States just wasn't safe, and she would be better off if she stayed in Canada and just sort of worked her way up the ranks in her current place of employment. Her coworkers were concerned as well. One, Chris, said that before she left, some of her colleagues had basically had an intervention with her. They sat her down and said, "Hey, if you do what you did here, when you get to Elwin, everyone's going to hate you."
What?
Yeah.
If you did what? And why are, who's going to? Who documented this?
So this is where things get a little bit interesting, right? Because, like, you can tell, like, Donna's thoughts on Dee Dee as well as Chris's are kind of surprising. People are, like, publicly sharing these moments with her, because do I think that many of the women who are, you know, characterized as being, like, you know, perfect actually had complicated relationships? We're just not hearing about it. Yes. But so, like, why is this coming out? Like, we know, of course, that at some point Dee Dee is going to go missing, right? Because that's the point of our program. But a lot of this comes to light in reporting that happens after she goes missing. And many of the people who are actually providing this insider information about Dee Dee are providing this information because they think that the person that they're talking to is a private investigator, but instead he's a reporter.
So they're just, like, blurting out things that should not be said to a reporter?
Yeah. So, like, I don't, like, they did not
okay
think this would be made public. they're telling this to and who they assume is an investigator because they think that he's going to, like, mm-hmm. that knowing these kinds of things about her might help solve her case. So in some regards, like, what they're saying is, like, hard to hear. In other regards, what they're saying is, like, they're just trying to be, like, clear so that maybe there's some information here that might help, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not sure if he intentionally misled them or not, but, like, all of them, a lot of the people you're hearing from in this episode, like, they assumed this was not going to be made public.
Hmm.
Sorry, everyone, for making it public Yikes. Again.
Yeah.
I am doing it for a reason, though, so.
Okay.
Yeah. So, in any case, like, Chris, this coworker, he goes on to say, she brought out feelings in us we didn't think we had. She had the ability to bring out the worst in people. So you can see that harshness.
Yeah. Right?
Now, in October 1990, she does move to New Jersey to begin her new job, though, and she's excited. She moves to Cherry Hill, which is across the river from Philadelphia, and into a place called Somerset Towers, and she's on the top floor, which is the seventh floor. This does ease some of Blaine's concerns, Blaine the stepbrother.
Mm-hmm.
It's a secured building, so you have to enter in, like, security codes into security doors. And bonus, she's not too far from her longtime friend, Sherry. So to emphasize, like, she does have these, like, incredibly right. wonderful friendships, right? In the same month, though, that she moved in, a woman named Wendy Vons was stabbed to death in her apartment at the complex. The killer is quickly caught. It was Wendy's boyfriend who killed her. But this incident so soon after Dee Dee moved in likely rattled her and her family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's definitely proof to her stepbrother, like, I told you America is not safe, yeah. right? Now, in the months after, though, Dee Dee puts these fears aside. She begins settling into her new life. And it's really here that, like, the complicated portrait of her begins to emerge. At work, she's considered professional and dedicated, but like her colleagues in Canada tried to warn, she wasn't exactly well-liked by everyone at work.
It's funny because it seems like her personal relationships are amazing, but her work relationships aren't.
Right.
So it's just, when she goes to work, I'm just imagining this woman going with, like, this game face, like,
yeah,
she's all business at work.
I get that Possibly. Sense, like, she, like, she, when people talk about her in terms of work, one, it's, like, that she rubs people the wrong way at work, but on the other hand, like, her professionalism, her, like, way she conducts herself at work is, like, exemplary. So I think that, like, in some ways she's, like, grading them because she is really driven, she's really focused, right?
She's there to do her job, not to make friends.
Right.
Yeah.
But she does make a friend at work.
Oh, does she?
Yeah. So one of her new friends is this woman named Elizabeth. She's a psychologist at Elwyn. And the two began, like, planning regular social outings. They're together, like, all the time. They regularly meet after work, for instance, to get, like, Irish coffees. And during some nights, they'd go out to the bars. Dee Dee's friend Sherry had introduced Dee Dee to Philly's South Street back in Sherry's single days. So this is way back in 1983. So when they were both younger, mm-hmm. Sherry was, like, showing Dee Dee around. And so this was a familiar place for Dee Dee to go to. Now, Elizabeth wasn't always thrilled with this. Elizabeth's the new friend. Elizabeth says, there are some strange characters on South Street. I mean weird. And I'm from San Francisco.
Nobody has a filter.
No. No. I'm, like, reading all these, like, things, and I was just like, oh my goodness, okay, everyone. So this, though, doesn't seem to faze Dee Dee. Elizabeth said that she would strike up a conversation with anybody, and that sometimes they would encounter men who would invite them back to, say, another party or back to the military base, and that Dee Dee was often like, yeah, let's go. But Elizabeth wasn't always comfortable with this. Elizabeth, though, she does describe Dee Dee as being fearless. After all, Elizabeth said, Dee Dee was looking for a husband. She said Dee Dee would set her sights on finding a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant, but she would often date inappropriate men, like, in one instance, like, a cocaine user, or in another instance, a married man.
Not husband material.
Like, no.
No.
Neither.
Come on, Dee Dee.
Now, Sherry, Dee Dee's longtime friend, she seemed to echo this assessment of her friend. She said that essentially she knew that Dee Dee wanted what Sherry had at that point, like a marriage, a home, and children, but she just, like, wouldn't always pick the best men.
Mm.
On Friday, February 22nd, 1990, Dee Dee was working at Elwin's Vineland, New Jersey location. She ended her day at work by talking with coworkers about their plans for the following Monday when she would be back at work. And then she got into her white Honda Prelude and drove towards her apartment, which was 40 miles away. Along the way, at 4:46 p.m., she checked the balance in her bank account at an ATM. It showed that she had $681.70 in her account. Then 1 minute later, she withdrew $80. But when Dee Dee got back to her apartment, she was in for a shock. On her door was an eviction notice informing her that she had 5 days to move out due to failure to pay her rent. Because you see, that's the other thing that followed Dee Dee to the U.S., difficulty in managing her finances. Now, Dee Dee was making $27,000 a year at her job, which is about $63,000 in today's money. Plus, in the few months that she'd moved there, her family had gifted her at least $15,000 in cash. So, you know, about $35,000 in today's money. And her move, her car, and her television were paid off, but despite all this, she still owed about $2,000 in back rent, and she hadn't paid her cable or phone bills either.
That seems like a lot of money for a single woman.
Yeah.
Where is all of her money going if she's not paying her bills?
Right, because, like, given her salary...
Well, $15,000 in cash?
Yeah.
Like, I know that's $35,000 by today's standards, but, like, how fun would it be to just get a gift, $15,000 in cash for nothing.
Well, yeah, so, like, they're like...
But also, like, she didn't pay $2,000. That's, like, so little compared... A fraction of just the gift.
Yeah.
Not even counting what she's earning. Mm-hmm. Where is this going?
Right. Like, okay, so clearly, like, she is, like, the beloved baby of the family. Like, everyone spoils her, right? Like, yeah, so how does she end up in this, despite having what is, like, a strong financial position.
Yes. I think.
Remember, like, Donna, her old roommate back in Alberta, had said that Dee Dee often lived beyond her means to appear wealthy. So some of the things, like, she would do. So, for instance, when she had to go fly somewhere, she would take a limo service to the airport. And, like, she always wanted to fly, like, first class only.
Okay.
Even still, despite, like, all of this, like, we also know that she used her brother's credit card to rack up $13,000 on a trip to Mexico. So, like...
$13,000 on a trip to Mexico for one person?
It sounds like it, right? So she's not... She's great in so many things. Just not money management, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at this point... So she comes home, there's this eviction notice, she's just finished up her long day at work, and she sees this, right? She knows that she's just checked her account, she only has $600 remaining.
That's right!
In her account.
What? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So she has to pay $2,000, she only has $600 in money, right? So she's pretty upset.
Mm-hmm.
She tries calling her father, Victor, who primarily, it seems, lives in Florida, but she can't get a hold of him. So she's, like, not able to solve this problem on that night, right? She, like, she needs her dad. And then she gets a call around supper time from her friend, Elizabeth. Like, since it's a Friday night, the two of them are supposed to go to a bar called Quincy's on South Street. But Elizabeth was calling to do, like, a rain check on their adventure. Like, she was still at work, and she just wasn't feeling up to going out. Now, Elizabeth said that Dee Dee sounded disappointed and upset, but Elizabeth wasn't sure why when they could just go to a bar at a different time. So she called her back later because she was worried about Dee Dee, and that's when Dee Dee told her about the eviction notice. Dee Dee told Elizabeth that she still wanted to go out and check out the business crowd at the bar, essentially looking for suitable men, but, like, Elizabeth just wasn't budging. She was, I think, pretty tired. Now, Elizabeth said in the past, Dee Dee had gone to the bars alone, but when they ended their phone call, she didn't get the impression that Dee Dee was going to go do that night. She got the impression she was going to stay in. And Elizabeth was right. Dee Dee did stay in. Instead, Dee Dee called her friend Stephen, who was in Japan at the time. Like, the two had been friends for 15 years, and they walked through Dee Dee's options regarding her eviction notice. Stephen was suggesting that she would go and speak to, like, legal aid first thing on Monday, but she really scoffed at this suggestion. She felt like lawyers in the U.S. were not to be trusted.
Oh, she called Stephen in Japan to talk about an eviction notice because she doesn't have enough money in her bank account to pay for her rent?
Yeah.
How much is this phone call?
Oh, because like the long distance phone call. Probably a lot, but she also hasn't paid her phone bill, right? So she's calling Steven because he's been her friend for so long.
Okay, I get it. But, you know, let's call a local friend. Financially, our girl here.
Right, don't phone a friend in Japan.
Is making some mistakes.
Right, right. Oh.
I know.
So she's like not interested in pursuing this legally. Right, or going through the U.S. court systems to handle this. So they kind of leave it there for the night. And Dee Dee does have a few other phone calls. Like, we know that she called her mom. They talked about her next trip to Canada for Passover. We also know...
So we just called Japan and Canada.
Yes. Well, she's also trying to call Florida, which would have been long distance, too.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, everything was long distance.
Everything.
Yeah. So we also know she tried paging the building handyman, John, at least twice, but he didn't respond initially. And when he did finally get back to her, it was 9 p.m. And he said when he talked to her, she seemed a bit edgy, in his words. And then the two talked again at 10:30 p.m. And Dee Dee just, like, apologized to him for her attitude when she had spoken with him.
We'll be back in a moment.
Now, John would tell the papers that he would often cat sit for Dee Dee when she was out of town. Dee Dee owned a half Siamese, half Persian, also known as a ragdoll, named Felicia. I love that there's this cat named Felicia.
This ragdoll named Felicia, yeah.
So she's had Felicia since she lived in Alberta. She got her cat when she lived in Alberta, and her friends said, like, Felicia was, like, her surrogate kid, right? So John's, like, talking about, like, you know, that he would often cat sit, because what he's really trying to do is he's trying to establish why she might be calling him. But you know how I said her friends would often say she was, like, with inappropriate men?
Yeah. What are you getting at here? What's going on?
One of them was John, right?
Oh, no.
Like, John is married.
Oh, I was about to say, why is he inappropriate?
Yeah. I know. Sorry. John's married.
Okay.
And Dee Dee's friend Sherry said, like, the thing between John and Dee Dee was just casual. Like, really, it sounds like Dee Dee's just kind of passing the time with John, right? John, though, ends up being the last person Dee Dee talked to that night.
Uh-oh. Are we about to go missing?
Well, so on Monday, Dee Dee's coworkers were surprised to find that Dee Dee wasn't at work, right? Because she is, like, super dedicated. This is extremely unusual because of how professional she was in her work obligations. And the executive director of Elwyn said she was a very reliable employee. Any other time she took off from work, we were notified. By that afternoon, two of her work colleagues, Ken and Jan, went to her apartment complex and spoke with the superintendent of the building, Nancy. The trio made their way to Dee Dee's apartment, and outside her door, newspapers were building up. When they tried to open the door, they found it unlocked. Nancy said it was an eerie feeling entering the apartment. After all, the October before, Nancy had been the one who opened the door to Wendy's apartment to find her murdered inside with the butcher knife used to kill her still in her chest. But the scene in Dee Dee's apartment is distinctly different than Wendy's. Ken said that it seemed like she'd been on the couch, maybe on the phone. The phone was on the floor and a throw blanket was, like, tossed over the back of the couch like she'd just gotten up. In the sink, there were a few glasses, but otherwise nothing seemed amiss. This is except for the fact that Felicia, Dee Dee's very much beloved cat, was stuck outside on Dee Dee's balcony. Even though everything looked fine, the fact still remains that Dee Dee was nowhere to be found and hadn't alerted anyone to her absence. So they called the police. When the police arrived, they found the same thing. Dee Dee's apartment was in order. Her shoes were inside. They were kicked off by the front door. Her car keys were on the counter. Her bed was made. They found the clothes that she wore to work on Friday, like, neatly hanging in her closet. Now, outside, they located her car, which was parked in an open outdoor lot. Like her apartment, the doors are unlocked, but inside they found her coat and her briefcase with her work papers inside.
So do we think she made it from the apartment to the car?
Yeah, so, you know, it really looks like from the scenarios that she got home from work, just didn't lock her car and then...
Oh, left her coat and briefcase inside, went inside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, what we often see in situations like this, you know, is that a case like this could easily be brushed aside. There's not something obviously wrong, but perhaps because of the recent murder in the complex, they immediately get to work on this case, like taking it seriously. Two schools of thought about what happened immediately rise to the surface. And this is the only reason that I shared Dee Dee's financial and romantic history, because they define those early inquiries into her disappearance. Like, my goal here was not to shame Dee Dee for her.
No.
Anything, right? The first theory is that because of her ongoing money issues, people wondered if she had run away or been done away with because of this. When her father hears this, he's kind of like, no. He says, she always knew she could call him if she needed money. He had done it in the past. If she needed $1,000, he would give her $3,000. He said, I don't know why she owes money, but if she needed money, she called Daddy. Following the idea that she could have left on her own, police did check. They checked flights, they checked bus and train tickets in her name, but there weren't any. Now, her Alberta roomie, Donna, wasn't quite as certain that someone didn't harm her. She said maybe someone tried to teach her a lesson with 20-pound weights on her feet.
What? That's so specific.
Donna, that's harsh, right?
Donna!
Like, again, incredibly harsh, but, like, keep in mind that Donna thought she was speaking to that private investigator and likely thought this information would help. Like, hey, I'm worried that someone could have wanted money from her. Is what she's saying. I mean, she could have worded it better, but...
I mean, come on.
Now, her longtime friend, Sherry, though, had a different theory. She said, I think she met the wrong person. She always picked the wrong person. She had been meeting the wrong person all her life, and this was really the wrong person. I think it finally caught up to her. This person who met her, maybe she didn't think she was going away for a long time.
But, I mean, I thought she was just mostly dating, like... married men or possibly guys like dabbling with drugs. Like, she do we know for sure that she's been like dating like actually like aggressive or potentially abusive?
So it doesn't seem that way, but again, like, what Sherry's trying to say is like that her friend like just didn't have
like the gauge to
like pick better guys, and so she's saying is like maybe she picked like the really wrong guy this time. Okay. Right. Now, it's Sherry who's able to provide investigators with the married handyman's name and the nature of Dee Dee's relationship with him. Police thought that, like, this might be their person. As a handyman, he had access to Dee Dee's apartment, and as her married lover, he might have had a motive there, right? Like, if the motive was, like, silencing Dee Dee to keep his marriage intact.
Mm-hmm.
When questioned, though, he said he did speak with her that night, but he had an alibi. He was out of town with his family. The only other clue came from an elderly neighbor named Lucy. She said that the early morning hours of Saturday, February 23rd, she woke up after hearing what sounded like a thump on the ceiling. That would have been Dee Dee's floor.
Okay.
She said it sounded like Dee Dee fell out of bed. She also claimed she heard the sliding glass door that led from Dee Dee's balcony into Dee Dee's apartment open and close, but because she had just woken up from sleep, she couldn't quite place if she had heard that before or after the thud. With little more to go on, police brought in a cadaver dog, hoping to find Dee Dee if her body was maybe somewhere in the building or in the vicinity. According to later reports, the dog did lead them from the building to a back fence, but that was it. In the months that followed Dee Dee's disappearance, police continued their investigation. Victor, her father, was tasked with cleaning out her apartment, and he removed her, like, bed, and he put it in storage. He cleaned out her kitchen, which still had her Clamato juice and her selection of party crackers. The open bottles of alcohol he distributed to the building workers, and within months, her apartment was rented out again. In the years since Dee Dee's disappearance, her story was covered on Unsolved Mysteries. Her episode aired 3 times, and each time it did, a flurry of new calls would come in with people believing they had seen her. Blaine, Dee Dee's stepbrother, traveled to the U.S. over 60 times, hoping to press the investigation forward. He even hired a private investigator, a move that essentially depleted his financial resources. He said finding Dee Dee was the only thing he could think of, and that his obsession actually led to the end of his marriage as well. He was determined to find a sister, though, and sadly, It would be years before he had any answers at all. Now, we're going to put a pin in that, and we're going to come back to Dee Dee in a second. But on October 6th, 1995, a woman in Tennessee received a startling phone call from her son that had her calling the police. The woman conveyed that if the police went to her home in Burlington Township, they would find her son who had just murdered a woman.
I don't know where you're going here.
I said we could, so could we,
I know.
I know, we would come back.
Okay, okay.
Okay.
I'll bear with you.
Now, for a lot of reasons that will quickly become clear, okay, I'm going to leave this murder victim's full name off of our podcast. For clarity, I will refer to her by her first name, which is Rebecca. But I'm also leaving out completely the name of her 14-year-old daughter. Now, this isn't to diminish them in any way. The daughter, who's now an adult, has made her name public. But in that instance, she made a choice to have that be out there. So, after receiving this call about a potential murder, police respond immediately. When they arrived at this Burlington Township residence, they found a man, who we're going to call E, sitting on the front steps with a 14-year-old girl. That girl, who was still dressed in her field hockey outfit from the day before, had just witnessed E brutally killing her mother, Rebecca. Rebecca and E had been dating for a while, but the daughter had no love for this man. In fact, she had finally convinced Rebecca to leave him, and the day before was supposed to be the day they were going to get in a car and drive to Rebecca's mother's house. Instead, the girl had left her field hockey practice to find E waiting in the car with Rebecca. She knew that he'd learned of their plan to leave, and he thwarted it somehow, and for some reason, Rebecca had gone along with it. E drove Rebecca and the girl back to his own mother's house, and he claimed he wanted to cook a family meal together. But when they arrived, there was no food. Taking Rebecca's car, he said he was, you know, going to go off to get some groceries and he would be back soon. Soon didn't happen. The hours stretched on, and finally around 9 p.m., the girl went upstairs and told Rebecca to wake her up when he got home so they could leave and they could go back to their original plan, right? Which is like the two of them are going to finally leave this man. Instead, the girl woke up to what sounded like arguing. When she went downstairs, she saw her mother, Rebecca, on the couch, and it was clear that E had been beating her. At the very least, the girl thought Rebecca had a broken jaw and maybe a broken arm as well. E then forced the girl to sit in a chair just feet from her mother. The girl would later say that she didn't know if her mom at that point had even realized she was there. The girl begged for E to let her and Rebecca go. Instead, he covered the girl with a sheet, but she saw him grab an 18-inch axe. E hit Rebecca as many as 27 times with this axe, primarily hitting her around the head and chest.
You just got gory there.
Yes.
Well, not you, but thanks.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that.
This, like, turn.
With the daughter.
Yeah.
That poor girl, like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's her mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, after he killed her mother, he brought the girl upstairs and sexually assaulted her for several hours.
And it just got worse.
Yeah. The girl said that later after that, he begged for her to kill him. Like, basically,
he wanted her to kill him?
Yes. So, you know, he basically said he didn't want to face any repercussions from what had just happened.
Okay.
And so he's asking her to kill him. She actually convinces him that it would be better if he turned himself in, reported the murder. She convinced him that they would be lenient with him.
Did he take it? Did he?
Yeah, so
he decided to do that?
Yeah. So there's two different versions. One is that, like, he calls his mother and that his mother is the one who calls it in.
Mm-hmm.
Others kind of skip that step and say he called police, but basically the police arrive. That's when the police arrive and they find them sitting on the front porch together. Now, when the police arrive, the girl is taken in to make a statement about what happened to her and her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And E is taken into custody. Now, not long after, E told the police he had another confession to make. It had to do with an unsolved case that happened in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Now, E would actually go on to make this confession twice. Once to cops after he waived his Miranda rights. The second confession he actually made to a journalist at a local paper. I guess everyone is talking to the journalists, right? Mm-hmm. But in both, he confesses to murdering Dee Dee. And what he says is quite detailed.
Okay, so was he a suspect before? Like, did Dee Dee know this guy?
Yeah, so he actually was a suspect before. Like, he had been. He had been a maintenance worker at her apartment complex, and he lived at the same complex with his girlfriend Rebecca and her daughter. Now, this is several years before, right? But when the police interviewed him initially, he had an alibi. He was home with Rebecca.
Wow. So he had been with Rebecca and her daughter for a long time before mm-hmm. this happened?
Yeah.
So he essentially raised this 14-year-old girl, helped raise her for years, and then still did those awful things to her?
Yeah. So he had been, I mean, I get the impression that some of their relationship was on again, off again. But yeah, he had been in a presence in her life for a very long time.
Hmm.
Right. And so Rebecca is actually the one who helps provide an alibi for him, saying that, yes, he was there in their apartment when Dee Dee went missing.
Hmm.
Now, on the night she disappeared, E had actually targeted Dee Dee. He said that he had heard about Dee Dee from one of the other workers, John, that married man she had been seeing.
Mm-hmm.
E claims that he'd also seen her around a few times and thought she was nice. That night, E was at a party in the complex using drugs, but he left and headed back to his apartment. Once there, he got into bed to go to sleep, but for some reason, he got back up and left his apartment. Now, using his building key, he accessed the roof. And from there, he was able to lower himself down to Dee Dee's balcony. Like, if you remember, Dee Dee's apartment was mm-hmm. on the top floor. So he just, like, went over the side and dropped down onto her balcony.
Hmm.
He said his intent was to rape her, but once inside her bedroom, he started going through her drawers. And at some point, she woke up and gasped. He said that's when he realized that she would be able to identify him. Now, the two struggled and Dee Dee slipped to the floor. This is likely the thump that Dee Dee's neighbor heard. E claimed he started hitting her, but first her heavy comforter was blocking his blows, so he pulled that away and hit her until she was unconscious. Then he covered her mouth and nose with his hands and started counting until he was sure she had stopped breathing. After, he claims he placed her back in the bed, and then he went to her living room and saw her purse. Rifling through it, he took $80 from her wallet and then left the apartment using her front door. Over the weekend, he said he saw newspapers being put outside her door and he became worried that she would be discovered. So he was able to re-enter her apartment because he'd not locked it when he left. From there, he took a cart and wheeled it into her apartment. In some reports, it claims that he wrapped her body in a painter's tarp. In others, that he used a sheet from her bed. I will say there are a few discrepancies in this story. So if you remember, her bed had been neatly made and no sheets were noted to be mm-hmm. missing. Also, he says that he waited a few days before removing her body, but there wasn't an odor in her apartment, nor did the cadaver dog alert in her space. But one standout clue that he was telling the truth was this detail about the $80.
Mm-hmm.
So while there had been news articles detailing her unlocked door and the newspapers outside, the detail about the missing $80 had been kept under wraps. In my research, I found where they reported various withdrawal and bank account slips, but not the specificity of $80. But the remaining question was, what did he do with Dee Dee's body? Mm-hmm. Where did he take her? He said that he wheeled the cart from the building to a nearby street where he placed Dee Dee's body in Rebecca's car. He said he drove about 20 miles south and in a marshy area near the Commodore Barry Bridge, which spans the Delaware River, he attempted to bury her body, but he had trouble shoveling. Instead, he picked her up and placed her in the weeds and left her there uncovered. Now, twice during his confession, he actually took investigators to the area he thought he left her, but they didn't locate her. Now, in 1988, 3 years after he murdered Rebecca, the case against him for her murder went to trial. By then, Rebecca's daughter was 17 and was forced to be back in the same room as the man who killed her mother and assaulted her, recounting what had happened to her. And the trial lasts just 5 days, but the jury deliberated for only 40 minutes before coming back with this guilty verdict. Even his defense knew the brutality of the attack and the assault on the girl played a huge role in the swiftness of this verdict. Now, the jury opted out of the death penalty on this case, but he was sentenced to 30 years to life for first-degree murder and 25 years to life for the kidnapping and sexual assault charges. So kidnapping because he held her against her will. The case for Dee Dee didn't come to trial, though, until 2001, which is 10 years after she went missing. E was offered a bargain. He could show police where her body was and the death penalty would be taken off the table. Though he agreed, the first time they tried to take him there was March 26, 2001. They made it just 100 yards from the correctional facility he was in before he was asked to just turn around. The second time they attempted, he just refused to leave the facility. When he went back to trial, the death penalty was back on order. Now, you might be wondering why he's facing a trial if he had actually confessed. There's two reasons. One, New Jersey at the time had a rule that said confession was not enough to prove guilt. It had to be backed up by other evidence. And this is actually really great because we know about like false confessions and those do happen quite frequently, actually. But also because, two, he decides to recant his confession.
Seriously?
Yeah. Now, during the actual trial, the defense alleges that Dee Dee is actually still alive.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
So for this, they use the fact that her body has not been found and also that people had claimed to see her in the years since. Like, particularly after those unsolved mysteries airings, like people would call in all the time. And we see this quite frequently in missing persons cases.
Right.
Like, it's good. People should be making those calls, right?
Right, but because you think you saw something, it doesn't mean you did.
Right, yeah. Like, if you think you see something, just sure.
Definitely, call let somebody in. Know, but you might not be right.
Exactly. Now, and that's what's used in this case, is like, oh, well, other people saw her, right? Now, despite all that, the jury deliberated just 4 hours in this case before he's found guilty, and he was given the death penalty. Now, shockingly, eventually this guilty verdict was overturned based on a technicality in that trial. And it's my understanding that it had to do with his right to self-represent. So he had asked to represent himself during the trial, and the judge was like, oh, whew, no. Now, he was ordered to stand trial again, but this time he took a plea deal, pleading guilty if the death penalty was off the table. So throughout all of this, though, Dee Dee still remains missing, and investigators acknowledge that it's unlikely her body will ever be found. If E was truthful, the marshy area he claims to have left Dee Dee is a dredging site for the Delaware River. Like, essentially, every year they dredge the river of silt and mud and debris, and they kind of dump it in the same area where he says she is. If that's true, her body would likely be 50 to 100 feet below all of this dredged material.
That's absolutely awful.
Yeah.
Like, how would you? You can't.
You can't.
You will never find her.
Yeah. So it's like this, there's not this possibility for this resolution.
Right.
Right. Like, her family cannot bring her home.
Ugh.
Now, again, despite the way that people responded to Dee Dee, just like, I want to make clear how loved she was by those in her life. She had, again, she had these deep and long-term friendships with many people. And her brother Blaine essentially destroyed everything in his life in order to find her. And her parents also loved her deeply. Her mother said that she knew for certain that something had happened to Dee Dee and that she hadn't just run away because her birthday passed without Dee Dee calling her. And she knew that nothing would have stopped her daughter from wishing her a happy birthday. And her father said, I have one little daughter and I lost her. I lost 170 people in the Holocaust, but I have only one little girl from my family and now she's gone.
We're now going to listen to Amy's poem, A Word for What Once Was, read by Laura Ault. Originating from Dallas, Texas, Laura has cultivated her multimedia talents from an early age. While initially drawn to music, where she showcased her natural talent for creating melodies on the piano, her passion for theater took center stage during college. Following the completion of her associate's degree in 2000, Laura made the bold move to New York City to pursue a career in musical theater. Amid auditioning for Broadway and earning her bachelor's degree, Laura achieved another noteworthy feat: writing, producing, and recording 2 albums. These albums have not only been licensed for film and TV, but have also opened doors for her to write specifically for acclaimed shows like All My Children and General Hospital. No stranger to the creative realm, Laura's dynamic artistic pursuits extend beyond acting. Based in Miami, Laura continues to balance her artistic endeavors with maintaining her fitness, raising two children, and passionately advocating for mental health and breast cancer awareness. Her commitment to these causes reflects her dedication to making a positive impact beyond the entertainment industry. Amidst her various projects, including a musical comedy short film and a full-length romantic comedy, Laura Alt's diverse talents and unwavering dedication to her passions continue to captivate audiences, making her a force to be reckoned with in the world of entertainment.
A word for what once was. Dee Dee Rosenthal, 32, missing since February 22, 1991, from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. They are dredging the Delaware again, pulling silt, clay, and gravel from the riverbed. The sturgeon swirling in the waters as the whole of everything they knew disappears before them. Above, men are changing the topography of the world, shaping it for the ships that pass from ocean to port and back. Different ships, different men, all believing this place is theirs to transform. The shore where your body was laid down that winter is no longer there. It's buried beneath the layers of debris. Once river, now land. What if I can't stand in the same place you once were? There are words in other languages that speak to this loss. A word for something that once was. A word for something that maybe never existed at all.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com.
Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.